Good evening, and welcome to the National MS Society Lone Stars Research Update Conference. Your host, Alicia Barron, will now begin.
Thank you so much, Alicia. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us this evening. I really appreciate your time. We're very excited to have Dr. Ford with us from the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center, and he's going to be giving us a little update on research that's happened in multiple sclerosis and hopefully some emerging therapies that are coming down the line. So thank you so much, Dr. Ford, for joining us. Please take over.
Well, thank you very much. So I'm not sure what everybody is seeing. If you're tied in, you can see the slides that I'll be using. I'm not going to go through these word for word. They're partly to give, just remind me about subjects and information that I want to convey to you tonight. As I said, I'm Corey Ford. I work at the University of New Mexico MS Center, and we're going to talk tonight about new and emerging therapies for MS. This will take maybe 45 minutes, I think, and then there'll be time for some questions afterwards. So if you're looking at this slide, it's basically to remind me to tell you that MS is a inflammatory, demyelinating disease of the central nervous system, the brain and the spinal cord, and that inflammatory cells from the blood leave the blood and move through the blood-brain barrier into the brain and initiate damage to the myelin insulation around axons and nerves in the brain and spinal cord, and then that can actually cause some of those to be cut in a way that is analogous to cutting an electric wire, and that may be what leads to permanent symptoms of MS, like vision loss or weakness or numbness. We sometimes think about MS as an imbalance between immune processes that are inflammatory and those that are anti-inflammatory. And you always have both of those going on at the same time in your body. But in MS, maybe that balance gets a little out of whack and it tilts more towards the inflammatory side of things. And therefore, this attack of the immune system on myelin and the brain and the nervous system occurs and symptoms happen. And what we try to do or think that we're trying to do with some of the drugs that we have to treat MS is to restore that balance somewhat, so to tilt it back where anti-inflammatory and inflammatory processes are more in balance, and so that damage doesn't occur so much. So MS is a lifelong disease that can be treated today and is being treated better all the time, but to date we haven't been able to cure it. Sometimes we can stabilize it so that there is really no new activity occurring, which maybe is the next best thing to a cure. But in a way, you could think of it perhaps like high blood pressure or diabetes that can cause lots of problems of stroke and heart disease and blindness and other problems. But if you take the medications, you can prevent a lot of those. And you can treat hypertension. You can treat diabetes. But neither of those are curable either, so if you stop taking those medications, well, then the symptoms come back. And MS is getting to be like that. Many times we can stabilize the disease. We have an expanding line of drugs to try, so we're less likely now to accept activity that we might not have had any choice to accept some years ago. And in a way, I think we're getting to the point where most people can live with MS if they can find a drug that works for them and that they tolerate. So, you know, there are several disease-modifying drugs that have been around a long time, the interferons and glatiramer acetate or Copaxone. Both of those have been around for over 20 years. They are known to reduce disease activity in terms of relapses and slowing disability. They reduce MRI activity, so we get the sense that they do the things that we need them to do to be effective for MS. And then there are some drugs that we would consider second-line therapies. An example of that might be the chemotherapy mitoxantrone, which is not being used very much anymore now because it's so toxic, but it was a second-line drug that would sometimes be used for aggressive relapsing MS or sometimes even for secondary progressive MS. And probably the most commonly used so-called second-line drug now is natalizumab or Tysabri, which is given once a month and is very effective at controlling MS activity, but has some potential toxicities in the form of the PML virus that some people get, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that as we go on. So what's the problem with these older drugs, these glatiramer acetate and interferons? Well, they required injections either into muscle or into the skin, and so there was a long-term problem with giving those drugs. After many years, people would get tough skin, and it's just maybe a difficult thing after 10, 15, or more years to continue to inject yourself. They also had partial efficacy, so sometimes there was breakthrough disease activity, and we needed better, potentially more effective drugs. Sometimes people would get injection site reactions and other side effects like flu-like symptoms from the interferon or liver enzymes or redness and bruising and that kind of things. And adherence to a drug that you have to give yourself a shot for is sometimes a problem. You know, people get tired of giving themselves shots, so they skip them. And if you skip too many, well, you know, if you're not taking a drug, you can't really expect it to be effective. So for a lot of reasons, although these are good drugs and they still are a mainstay platform for treating MS, we needed different kinds of drugs and options, and fortunately, we're getting those. So some of the drugs that are emerging and are appearing, either have or will soon appear, are a class of drugs called monoclonal antibodies. The Tysabri or natalizumab is an example of one of those, and it's given by vein once a month. The names of some of the drugs that are under development are alemtuzumab, daclizumab, rituximab. These are complicated words to say, but they are all very different. They have very different targets. They do different things to alter the immune response, and all of them have some promise as important treatment agents for MS. Then there are the drugs that you all want and we like to have, which are the oral agents, and one of those, fingolimod, otherwise known as Gilenya, has recently been approved last year by the FDA for the treatment of relapsing MS, and it is also approved as a potential first-line therapy along with interferon and glatiramer acetate. So we'll talk about the issues associated with that drug as a first-line agent. And then there's a series of other oral agents. Cladribine was one that was well into advanced stages of development, but could never clear the regulatory hurdles in Europe or in the United States, and so cladribine just recently was dropped from further development. So it's an immune suppressive drug, and it was just difficult to arrive at sort of the risk-benefit ratio or profile for that drug in a way that satisfied our FDA. So I'm only mentioning that because it was something you probably have been hearing about but is no longer going to be subject to further development. Another interesting drug, teriflunomide, laquinimod, and a fumarate called BG12, and I'll mention each of those a little bit later in the talk. So one of the questions will be, as we develop these new agents, what will be their indications? Unfortunately, or I guess it's a reality in a way, these drugs are always tested first in relapsing remitting MS because it's the easiest form of MS to treat and the easiest to measure because you can count relapses and you can measure MRIs and disability and get an answer to whether the drug is effective or not in a trial that maybe runs 2 years or so. The characteristics of a good first-line therapy would be it's easy to administer, so pills certainly fit that bill, that it's efficacious or works over a meaningful timeline, that it's safe over the long term, that you can tolerate it over the long term, that if there are adverse effects, that they're manageable, and you'd like not to have to monitor for a lot of adverse effects, like drawing blood, for example, on a routine basis or a regular basis to look for problems. And it would be nice if insurance covered them with reasonable copays and that they were maybe inexpensive. And that's also a goal that has yet to be met, and most of these drugs are extraordinarily expensive, unfortunately. there will be some new issues with the MS disease-modifying drugs. So although they'll obviously be approved because they work for MS, they may come with new or different kinds of adverse effects from the drugs that you've come to know, the interferons and glatiramer acetate. So in some cases, there have been instances of malignancies like skin cancers and others. There are potential cardiac problems, heart problems with some of these, slowing of the heart rate or rhythm disturbances. There's some evidence of some pulmonary or lung issues that fortunately have not been significant. Eye problems like macular edema, problems with thyroid dysfunction or platelet dysfunction, both of which can be significant and may need long-term or interventions in a different way, separate from the MS. We don't know. A new drug really doesn't come typically with any evidence for its long-term efficacy, so you may prove that it works over a two-year clinical trial, but there won't be data about how effective that might be at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and beyond. And the same thing goes for safety. What you see in a safety profile in the early stages of development may change as more people are on the drug for longer periods of time, and that's an issue that developed with the Tysabri when it was approved, and it was only after it was marketed that the problem with the PML virus issue came to light. If you change to other therapies after having started one of these new drugs, there could be some unknown risks related to which drug you started first and whether that predisposes perhaps to other problems when you initiate a different drug. And so staging and transitioning from one agent to another is going to be a problem. As we have more than a few drugs to choose from, then it may become important to have some thought about which drug to start first and second and so forth as we move through the options. So risk-benefit assessments are obviously a major part of any drug development, and a lot of the clinical trials recently seem to indicate that we may be doing better as far as benefit of the drugs on endpoints important to people with MS, like better reduction of attacks or better slowing of disability or more effectiveness in halting the new lesion formation on an MRI scan. The problem with studies is that they're done at different times with different groups of patients, and although it's very tempting and maybe even almost irresistible to compare the results from two different trials, that's really not something that's scientifically valid in most cases. You can't look at, say, the effect on relapses in one study and say that it's twice as good or significantly better than the effect on relapses in another study because they're done differently and they had different placebo groups, and it just doesn't really work out well. It may be that this increase in benefit that we think we're seeing may come at a price of more risk. So, for example, the drug most recently approved, fingolimod or Gilenya, which is the first oral agent ever approved for treating MS, has some increase in opportunistic infections. Most of those are mild pulmonary-type infections that aren't are easily treated. There is a possibility that it can make herpes virus like zoster, shingles virus appear more often, and so the recommendation is that patients be screened to see if they had chickenpox and if they still have antibodies to the herpes zoster virus, and if not, we can now vaccinate for that virus to at least head that off. It's associated with a slowing of the heart rate, which is predictable and usually not significant or symptomatic, but sometimes it is, and so when you start that drug, if you have, some of you who have done that know that you are watched for 6 hours after the first dose to make sure that you don't develop symptoms of lightheadedness or other problems related to that heart effect. After the first dose, that doesn't occur. So you know, these are unusual or at least different kinds of side effects and issues than we've experienced with the drugs that we had before. In the United States, patients going on this fingolimod drug go to an ophthalmologist for a screening examination, and then another one maybe 6 months after starting the drug to make sure that they're not developing macular edema. There's some thought, there was some evidence that there may be a slight increase in certain skin cancers, which are obviously mostly treatable, but that doesn't seem to be particularly significant at this time, but we still have vigilance for the potential problem like that. So there are a lot of advantages to oral agents. We're all glad to have them. Obviously, there's an increase in comfort relative to drugs that you have to give by shots under the skin or into a muscle or even putting an IV into a vein. They're portable. You can take the pills in a bottle very easily with you when you're traveling, going on vacation or somewhere else. They're less invasive, and you don't get quite that reminder that you have MS as when you maybe unpack a syringe and give yourself an injection. You ought to be able to go to a pharmacy and get these, so it's not so difficult and relying on mail and that kind of thing to deliver it, and you don't need injection training. But although it seems like this would be the ideal, the oral agents will also come with their own set of issues. So they may have long-term effects that limit how you can change to other therapies. Because they're pills doesn't mean that they won't have side effects or potentially adverse effects, and so many of them will have monitoring requirements that could be significant. So you may have to have even more blood draws and checks of liver enzyme or skin checks or eye tests and such to monitor the use of these drugs. You may even find yourself going to the doctor more often than you were before on the interferon or the glatiramer acetate when you're taking some of these newer agents. Safety profiles may be more worrisome than what we've had before. We've had the glatiramer acetate and the interferons for 20 years, and by and large, these are very safe agents. There haven't been any very worrisome or rare kinds of things or anything more than rare kinds of things that limit their safety. And these drugs are, the new ones, I mean, the pills are expensive, and they are in most cases significantly more expensive than the older agents. The other question, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, was how will we stage moving from one disease-modifying treatment to another? Why would you do that? Well, we're going to be changing therapy more often, I think, because as you have more choices, then your tolerance for inadequate treatment and ongoing disease activity or disability is going to drop, and we may not wait as long on a given drug before we recommend changing to another one to see if it's possible to do better. So suboptimal effects would be a major reason to change. Maybe MRI activity, from time to time we check MRIs, and MS can have a certain silent character that lesions can develop that you can see on MRI that may not be associated with symptoms, but at some level have some role in indicating how well the treatment's working. The pills may not be tolerated well. They may have adverse effects, as we said. Patients have a choice in this, and insurance in some cases is driving what our choices will be. So although fingolimod is approved as a first-line agent, I think many practitioners find that the insurance plans are requesting or demanding that their patients, their insured patients, start one of the previous drugs like glatiramer acetate or interferon first, and if that works, then that's what they stay on, and only if it fails or it's intolerable do they allow you to move on to this new oral agent. So it is first line according to the FDA, but there can be other reasons why you don't get it first. And then are we going to use these new agents to so-called rescue people having failed drug A? What are the issues for changing to drug B? For example, we used to change people from glatiramer acetate to interferon or interferon to glatiramer acetate, and that was really not a decision or a change that made people worry very much. But with other drugs now, like natalizumab or Tysabri, where the effects may last 6 or 9 months or longer, or a drug like alemtuzumab, which I haven't talked about in detail yet, but the effects of that drug on the immune system can last for a year. In fact, that's the current dosing interval. You get alemtuzumab once a year because the effects last that long. So in a sense, if you flip the switch on some of these drugs, you can't unflip it if there's something that happens that you don't like. So maybe a strategy, a very simple one, would be if you're starting a new drug, maybe you start the ones that are short-acting first, like glatiramer acetate or interferon or fingolimod, which has a relatively short half-life. And I mentioned the dosing and monitoring issues. Glatiramer acetate really didn't require any monitoring. You didn't need to get your blood drawn or anything else, and it's been safe over 20 years. Interferons, usually you had one or two or three liver enzyme checks during a year while using that. Sometimes people needed their white blood cell counts checked, or you had to be checked for neutralizing antibodies just to make sure that the drug was still effective. But, those are a nuisance, but they weren't that difficult. Fingolimod or Gilenya now, we're going to be monitoring for infections, so the slowed heart rate on the first dose, the macular edema, and some patients on that drug do develop elevated liver enzymes, and that requires you to stop for a while, see if the enzymes go back to normal, and then restart. And, of course, if you wait more than a week, or roughly a week, you have to go back through that six-hour startup period again for the slowed heart rate observation. And then with the natalizumab or Tysabri, if anybody is on that or knows people who are on it, that drug requires ongoing monitoring because of the PML virus infection that can be released in maybe 1.5 patients in 1,000 and can be a very significant, even fatal infection. So we have ways to stratify patients by risk now that make that easier to do, but it's still a major issue with the use of natalizumab. We don't know yet whether there'll be cumulative risks with some of these new agents. As I mentioned, we've had 2 decades of use of the earlier drugs. We kind of know what they do and don't do, and for some of the newer agents, we don't have that length of time for follow-up, so we don't know what might pop up down the road as more patients are on them for longer periods of time. And that's especially true if you think about adding any drugs to some of these, because clearly those haven't been tested. There have been a few studies combining drugs. For example, a major one that's coming to its end soon is the CombiRx trial that has had patients on either glatiramer acetate alone, interferon alone, or the two together. To answer that long-standing question, do those two drugs, which work by very different mechanisms, work better together than either alone? And we will have some pretty good answers to that probably within the next year. And then, making decisions about these drugs and how to use them or what to do at certain points is going to be hard to make on a data-based or a data-driven process because the data won't exist. And the studies of more than one of these drugs together are going to be very difficult to do. They take large numbers of patients for long periods of time, and so there are a lot of reasons why it's going to be hard to prove that combinations of drugs are safe and effective. So to summarize, the existing disease-modifying drugs, and by that I mean primarily the glatiramer acetate and interferon, I think are going to continue to have a central role in the treatment of relapsing remitting MS for some time, for a number of reasons. One, they're known to be safe. They're known to be effective. They have a profile that the insurance plans understand, and they tend to be a little less expensive. However, the emerging MS disease-modifying drugs are not only needed but welcome, and to the extent that those are oral, that's a great step forward for patients as far as convenience and tolerability. Should be easier to administer some of those drugs. We do need to continue to work on monitoring and tracking plans and be careful about combining therapies where we don't know what will happen if you combine two different drugs in the same patient. Costs, I think, are going to increase, and as I said, the clinical trials are going to be more difficult. So what I'm going to do now is move to a discussion briefly of the major new drugs that are either out or are coming along. And if you have the slide up on your screen, this is a list of potential new therapies in development. So you can see there are some in phase two, and then there's some in phase three, which is the kind of study that leads to a submission for FDA approval. And those include some of the drugs I mentioned, teriflunomide, which is a pill, liquinimod, which is a pill, BG12, which is a pill, diclizumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that's given under the skin, and alemtuzumab, which is a monoclonal antibody which is given intravenously once a year. And then the new drug application I mentioned had been filed for clatrabine, but that was removed from further development, so we won't be talking about that. And fingolimod, I didn't put on the list because it is approved and it is a first-line agent that can be considered for MS now, today. So here's how fingolimod got to be approved for relapsing remitting MS. It underwent several studies, as all these drugs do, and one of those was called the TRANSFORM study that actually tested fingolimod, the pill, against an existing drug, interferon. And there were two doses of the fingolimod that were used versus the injectable interferon drug over a 12-month study. So this is a head-to-head comparison. These are good because that tells you whether the drug is equal to or perhaps better than an existing therapy, and that makes decision-making and at least comparing the drugs much easier than trying to go between studies, which, as I mentioned earlier, is not something that's easy to do. So what I'm showing here, if you can see it, is the primary endpoint, which is always typically relapse rate, and both doses of fingolimod had a significant reduction in the attack rate compared to the interferon control arm of somewhere between 40 and 50% better. When we looked at the MRI activity, again, both doses of the test drug, the pill, were better than the interferon injection in number of new gadolinium-enhancing lesions or new T2, the white spot lesions that you see on MRI. They also looked at changes in brain volume or atrophy because, you know, if you have ongoing MS activity, you're damaging axons and other structures in the brain, and so to the extent that they are injured and damaged, then you may actually lose brain volume, and that can be associated with problems like memory problems and word-finding problems and other cognitive issues. So looking at the progression of brain volume or atrophy is another way to look at whether the drug is affecting something that's probably important in controlling MS, and in this case, both doses of the drug, fingolimod, were better at slowing the progression of atrophy than the interferon control arm. The second study that I was going to mention was called Freedoms 1, and this was the standard drug versus placebo kind of study, and it went for 2 years, as almost all licensing trials do for these kinds of drugs in MS. So again, two doses of fingolimod, the same two that were used against the interferon, were tested against placebo for 2 years. And here you can see that against placebo, there is a decrease in annual relapse rate, as expected, or at least as you would certainly want to see in a drug that worked for MS, 55 to 60% reductions in attack rate for the drug compared to placebo, both doses, about the same. It slowed the progression of disability, a very important endpoint because disability, of course, is the issue that really is important to people with MS. Attack rate is important, but it's attacks that lead to disability or progression of MS that leads to irreversible disability. That's the real issue in what makes MS a difficult disease. And both doses of the drug, again, slowed the progression of disability compared to placebo in a significant way. Excuse me. And then again, as you expect, MRI activity was decreased by 75 to 80% in both doses. And also the brain atrophy was slowed in both years one and year two compared to placebo. So the drug is doing all the things that you want to see in a drug that's effective for MS: slowing attack rate, slowing disability, slowing the progression of brain atrophy. And both of the doses of the drug, the lower dose and the higher dose, were essentially the same. There was no difference between the two. So at the end of the day, the FDA, of course, approved the lower dose as the approved drug for MS. And so if you get put on fingolimod or Gilenya, you get 0.5 or a half a milligram tablet per day. The next slide, if you have it, is a list of the common side effects or adverse effects that patients experience with this drug at a half a milligram. And the important point is that if you look at all of the adverse effects with the drug compared to the placebo, it's really not very different. There are some side effects that are a little more or are more significant or frequent, I guess is the right word, in the fingolimod group. For example, liver enzymes are more increased on patients with the drug than without. There's a drop in white blood count because of the way that the drug works. There's some increases in things like headaches and your upper respiratory infections and so forth. But really, there are no – the important thing is there's no deal breakers in here yet, and the drug is being monitored carefully, now getting close to the first year of use widely as an approved drug. And hopefully another shoe doesn't drop, and this drug proves to be a relatively safe, effective, long-term first-line treatment for MS to join the other first-line drugs, the interferons and glutamyl acetate. Another interesting oral drug that's under development is called lecanemab, also being tested in relapsing, remitting MS. And it has completed some phase two, which is the earlier studies designed to show that the drug is safe and also to get some hints of benefit or efficacy. And it's also been into some later studies that show that there is a reduction in gadolinium-enhancing lesions on MRI. The safety profile so far is very good. There are sometimes some reversible elevations in liver enzymes, but most of those go back to normal even without stopping the drug. And so it appears to be a very safe drug, and if the efficacy benefits persist, it may be one of the next oral agents that could conceivably be approved for use. It's not approved as we speak. So in the phase three trial that was recently reported, again, these are the studies that generate the data that the FDA really likes to look at as they consider benefit. Again, a two-year study. There was a slowing in the rate of progression of disability, that endpoint that I think is probably the most important. At least a third of slowing of the progression of disability over 2 years in patients receiving this oral agent compared to placebo. And good reductions in MRI activity, maybe not as big as some of the other drugs, but they are in the direction that you need to see or expect to see for a drug that's effective in MS. Fewer new lesions, fewer new gadolinium-enhancing lesions, slowing of brain atrophy, for example, all positive, suggesting that this drug certainly has some promise, and we will be hearing the answer on that relatively soon, I think. Another oral drug is called dimethyl fumarate. It goes by the short name of BG12, which is the name that it's given while it's in study. Fumarates are relatively simple compounds. They've been used for a long time for psoriasis, a skin disease, and primarily in Europe, and they were effective. And psoriasis is an immune-mediated disease, so these drugs eventually made their way into testing in MS and showed some promise. So an early study with this drug, it was being tested against placebo. They were doing dose kinds of studies, giving a small dose once a day, a small dose three times a day, a higher dose three times a day to see how much you needed to give and how frequently to get benefit on MRI activity. And it was that higher dose at three times a day that had the biggest reduction in new lesions on MRI. So that's encouraging because it suggests that the drug could have some benefit in multiple sclerosis. But the problem, if there is one, is it did have some side effects. So it has some GI side effects, nausea and diarrhea and sometimes abdominal pains. It also causes flushing reactions, which are fairly prominent and fairly common. And they don't really seem to be that dose-related, but they are a bit. And if you have to take the drug three times a day, that probably will be one of the issues with this drug. It's hard to take a drug three times a day. It can be done, and that won't be a deal-breaker, but it would obviously be easier if it were a single once-a-day kind of dose, maybe like fingolimod. Another drug, an interesting pill that's being developed, teriflunomide, also has undergone phase 3 studies, so it is generating that licensing data for the FDA. And in a study with this drug against placebo, it also showed significant reductions in relapse rates compared to the placebo. It showed significant reductions in MRI activity, 40 to 70%. And so this drug is ongoing. It's being tested actually in not only relapsing MS, but clinically isolated syndrome and secondary progressive MS. So perhaps we'll have a drug with some data about different forms of MS in the very near future. I'm going to move now to brief discussions of some of the monoclonal antibodies. I had mentioned earlier a drug called alemtuzumab, a drug that's been around for quite some time. It has very potent and profound effects on T cells in your blood and B cells. B cells make antibodies, and T cells are the other important arm of the immune system. By binding to a certain protein on the surface of those two types of cells, this drug causes those cells to be eliminated from the circulation in essence. So your T cell and B cell count drops very, very low very quickly. The drug's given for 5 days once a year, and then you don't need treatment for the next year. So you would think, well, that sounds like a very aggressive, perhaps even dangerous thing to do. Surprisingly, the number of infections that patients get is quite low. And that's largely because another arm of the immune system that fights infections is unaffected by this drug. It does, however, have some unusual effects that bear monitoring, and I'll get to those in just a minute. So in the early studies, it showed a significant decrease in relapse rates, and this drug is being compared to one of the existing drugs, one of the high-dose, three-times-a-week type interferons. Because it is a potent drug, because it has significant toxicities potentially, it needed to be better than something that we already had. It couldn't just be a me-too kind of drug. And so it's being tested in earlier MS, but against an existing drug, namely the interferon, the high-dose interferon. And it had a very significant, much better reduction in attack rate than that interferon group. When looking at sustained disability, again, it was a very big difference between the interferon-treated patients and those who were given this alemtuzumab. And for the first time, if you looked at the disability scores in the patients who had received the interferon compared to those who were getting the alemtuzumab, the alemtuzumab group actually had a slight improvement. It's not a huge improvement in disability score, but it was an improvement. They actually had a decrease in their disability after 3 years on the drug compared to those on interferon who had some increases in disability. So because of this kind of encouraging early results, the drug is in phase 3 trials, again, in comparison to the active comparator, the interferon. And those studies are wrapping up and being closed out. The data should be available later this year. And we'll know whether this is a drug for certain kinds of patients to treat MS early and aggressively and perhaps get long-term control. It's important to note that some patients receive two doses of this drug and are now out 5 years or more without being retreated and are still doing better than the group that is on the interferon. So we're hopeful, and we're waiting to see. But in exchange for that potential increase in efficacy and benefit, perhaps comes more adverse effects and significant toxicity. So up to a quarter of the patients who receive this drug will develop autoimmune thyroid disorder, and that means they have to have their thyroid removed and go on thyroid replacement for the rest of their life. Well, that's not something that you'd want to do unless it was in exchange for a really potent and long-term beneficial effect on MS. Maybe that trade-off is acceptable because, you know, millions of people have hypothyroidism. They take thyroid replacement and they do very well. So it's not a deal breaker, but if the benefits of the drug are not significant or over an existing therapy, then it might not be worth putting a thyroid at risk. So that's kind of an issue there. There are a small number of patients, but certainly more than placebo or the interferon, can develop a platelet dysfunction called thrombocytopenic purpura, meaning their platelet count drops because of an immune attack on their platelets, and that puts them at risk for bleeding. And that bleeding can be inside the brain and be fatal. It is treatable, but it has to be monitored. So a patient who gets bruising or gets a platelet check and it's low needs to have that treated appropriately with different kinds of therapy just to make sure that a complication doesn't develop. So, you know, there are other issues, but this is a drug that is moving along, and we'll soon know whether it's going to be an option. Another monoclonal antibody is rituximab, which another drug that's been around for a long time. In some ways, it has some similarities to the alemtuzumab, but this one only takes the B cells out, doesn't take the T cells out. And so it was tested in a phase 2 trial and had very significant reductions in MRI activity, new lesions, and gadolinium-enhancing lesions. And why did it not move on into phase 3 and be developed for FDA submission? I think it was because the drug was close to the end of its patent life, and had the company decided to develop rituximab to completion, it might have been a drug that was susceptible to generic drug manufacturing. And to avoid that, they changed to a different antibody that works the same way, but is different. It's fully humanized, so it looks like it's a human immunoglobulin, and started all over in the testing from phase 2 through phase 3. It seems to have similar benefits and effects and toxicities and a similar safety profile as the rituximab, but essentially had to go back to the drawing board and put in another 4 to 5 years of development in order to bring that drug to market. So there can be lots of complicated reasons why drug development is slow, and promising avenues may be delayed for reasons other than safety and efficacy. The last drug I think I'll talk about is teclizumab, another monoclonal antibody that binds to another receptor on T cells. And that binding keeps the T cells from expanding themselves. So if they happen to be a population of T cells involved in the MS attack, then they wouldn't create more copies of themselves, and that may be beneficial. It also makes other changes in the immune process that seems to help restore balance to this pro-inflammatory versus anti-inflammatory balance that we were talking about early on. And this drug is in later stages of development. It has benefit on MRI activity as well as attack rate, and seems to be well tolerated and has a pretty good safety profile so far. So this is another one that I think has a significant possibility of entering the treatment regimen for MS. It's given subcutaneously, but not on a daily or even weekly basis. So it will be a bit more convenient, perhaps, should it prove to be effective. So to summarize, the oral medications and the monoclonal antibodies are going to provide us, and have provided us in some cases, with new therapeutic approaches to the treatment of MS. The risk-benefit profiles are important. We value safety and as much as we do efficacy in a disease like MS that doesn't typically shorten life We need to be able to treat people for decades, not just months or years. And so the drugs have to be safe and tolerable in addition to being effective. And it's looking like many of the choices that are under development are going to meet those criteria. So we're optimistic. The more choices we have, the less MS disease activity we have to accept. And I think the future looks very bright. There are other drugs going into studies, and this story is far from the end. So to finish up, I just put in a few slides to tell you just a few things that you might be interested in, like vitamin D. Vitamin D is an interesting story. For almost since we knew what the distribution of MS was in the world, it was noticed that people in northern latitudes had much more MS than people at southern latitudes. As you move towards the equator, MS is much less common. And why is that? And no good answer ever was available, but some thought came that maybe it has to do with sunlight, and the more sunlight you have, the lower the incidence of MS. Well, how would that work? Well, vitamin D is made in the skin, and when sunlight strikes the skin, the vitamin D precursors are turned into vitamin D, and vitamin D does have some connections to the immune system. It was noticed in small studies that MS activity increased in the winter. There were some small studies that suggested supplementing vitamin D might reduce relapses. It was looked at with MRI and didn't show any changes there. But the epidemiology studies in large groups of MS patients and in children shows a pretty strong link between vitamin D levels and either the onset of MS and in some cases the severity of MS. And so I think the thinking is that there is a role there. The exact mechanism has yet to be worked out. It's not totally clear that an MS patient with developed disease as an adult will do better taking supplemental vitamin D, but it is a safe thing to do if you don't overdo it. And so, taking vitamin D is not an unreasonable thing to do. Maybe it's more important in children to maintain their vitamin D levels. That would be a difficult study to do, but I think people are interested in whether vitamin D and vitamin D levels in childhood could have some way of reducing the incidence of MS. Occasional patients come in and they want to know about medical marijuana. We're one of the states that has medical marijuana laws. There are others. There are issues there. I have given it to some patients. I'm somewhat slow to do so, and I don't think it's the best answer for the vast majority of people. There are a lot of issues depending on where you are. For example, federal law trumps state law, and the two sometimes are at odds. And so just because a state says it's okay doesn't mean the federal government will go along with that. And so there are legal issues for patients who are walking around with it. It's thought that it may help some kinds of neuropathic pain or spasticity. It gives some people a sense of well-being. It may be good in some patients for tremors. But to my mind, marijuana has significant issues if you're still working. Certainly there are jobs where any kind of drug use would be a potential reason to let you go. Marijuana is a psychoactive drug that tends to impair people. It's never been known to make people smart. So it can affect cognition, and driving under the influence would be an issue. So I mention it just in passing, but I think that there are better choices for almost all of the symptoms that marijuana would typically be used for. Another agent I wanted to mention was 4-aminopyridine, otherwise known as Ampyra or dalfampridine. This was approved a couple of years ago, and as you may know, it's a drug that has no effect on the MS disease activity, but it does bind to damaged nerves and may improve their function. And so it's approved for helping people walk faster and farther, and it often does that, maybe in about half or so patients. The other half don't seem to get much benefit. It has some side effects, and one of those is if you take too much, you can have a seizure. And lastly, we have the alternative medicines, complementary medicines. People change their food, their diet. Sometimes they go for acupuncture. There are endless numbers of supplements you can buy online or at the health food store, a whole catalog of herbs and vitamins, and some people are still using bee stings. And I guess my thought on that is people have different well-being needs and things that work for them and that they like to take, and most of these things are not dangerous. Whether they help MS or not is very much in question. Most of them have lots of claims and little or no data, and my advice for almost all of those would be, if you're going to do that, if you're going to take these alternative and complementary medicines, don't give up on the proven medicines. Give yourself the benefit of both. Take both, and maybe that's the best answer for treating MS. I've run about 5 minutes past the time I was supposed to, but I think we have enough time for questions. And so I hope that helps give you a little perspective on where we're going, what we have, what we will soon have, and some of the issues that we'll have to answer over the next few years as we learn better how to employ these new drugs in treating people with MS. Thank you very much for calling in tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the number one key. Again, if there are any questions or remarks, please press the number one key at this time. Okay, we do have a question or comment from Paula in Houston. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask, have you ever heard of any benefit of taking lisinopril in treatment of MS?
The blood pressure medicine?
Yes.
You know, I have not. I have not. I think that's a calcium channel blocker, and I'm not aware of a reason why or anybody who's thought that it might be helpful in MS.
Okay, thank you.
There are no more questions in queue.
Dr. Ford, this is Alicia. I hope you don't mind if I ask you a question. I was wondering if maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what do you say to patients that are considering getting on clinical trials? Is there some criteria they should look at, or kind of what are some suggestions?
Well, that's a good question. So we do clinical trials for at least a couple of major reasons. One is we want to be part of developing better and more effective ways for treating MS. And in the process of doing that and having a clinical trial, we can often offer people access to treatments that might otherwise be unavailable to them for various reasons. Maybe they're not available at all, or they're not something that is affordable, or they don't have insurance. So the clinical trials offer a lot of reasons to, or a lot of ways to get the latest potential better treatments for MS and to contribute to the furthering of the field. And there are a lot of studies going on. It's very important that we find people who are willing to at least consider joining a study if they are eligible. So different studies have different criteria. Maybe it's for relapsing remitting MS, or in some cases now there are some secondary progressive trials. There would be criteria about, you know, what your disability is, whether you need to be able to walk, what maybe some limitations if you've taken certain other drugs. You may have to wash out, or you may not be able to get in at all if you've ever had them. It just varies. So if you live near a center that engages in clinical trials and you have an interest, I think it's worth making the call, or, you know, checking to see if there is a study ongoing or enrolling that you might be interested in. You can find out about ongoing studies on the National MS Society website, and you can also go to a website that the government runs called clinicaltrials.gov, where they list all clinical trials. You can just type in the disease you're interested in, and it will tell you what's ongoing. So that's a good question, Alicia. I think it's another option for treating MS that can be very rewarding.
Thank you, Dr. Ford.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number one key. Ms. Barron, there are no callers in queue.
Okay. I have one further question, Dr. Ford. I'm sorry, I'm going to be the one that asked you all the questions tonight. I understand there was a study that came out here not too long ago. I think we just got a notification of it, or some information that came out that potentially there was some kind of new data that they had found on something to do with nervous system repair or with actual, like, repair of the myelin. Have you heard about that study, or do you know anything that's happening in that particular realm?
You know, there's only early data on whether any current approaches that we have, I think, lead to meaningful restoration or repair of nervous system damage. You know, the nervous system, I think the safest thing to say is that the nervous system can undergo some degree of self-repair. So axons can't be recreated as far as we know, but myelin can be, and other cells that are important to the conduction of electric impulses can be repaired in patients who have MS. And so if you stop or limit the MS activity, that gives the brain and the nervous system more time and more chances to undergo that repair. So in some sense, all drugs that decrease MS activity are probably leading to some increase in repair and, you know, improvement in conduction. Whether you see that as an improvement in function, you know, strength or vision or energy or something like that, well, that, you know, that may or may not be easy to know. I'm not aware of, you know, exactly what study you're referring to, so I'll kind of pass on that. But it's certainly a major area of interest, finding neuroprotective and neuro-repair strategies that can help patients who already have damage and symptoms.
Great, thank you. I'll give everybody a minute. If anybody else has any questions, please press the number one key right now. And it doesn't...
Oh, we do have a question from Michael. Please go ahead.
If any of your slides will be available through the MS Society, any of your presentation or your slides?
I had not made any plans to do that. Were you interested in some of them, or?
Yeah, I'd like to see some of the slides.
Well, maybe you can contact Alicia, and then we can see what would be helpful to you and see what we can work out.
Okay, thank you. It was a very good presentation.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ford. This was just a really very educational presentation, and I think this
Ms. Barron?
Yes,
I'm
ma'am.
Sorry. We have one more question from Paula.
No problem.
Paula, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I did have one more question. It kind of piggybacks off of one of the previous questions. This was that Alicia asked. This was in regards to DR6. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, you mean the HLA antigen DR6?
Right, DR6.
Right. Well, that's the patients with MS have a high incidence of HLA DR6 allele subtype in their genetic makeup. That's been known for a long, long time, and no other gene or marker in the genome has ever approached that in terms of its frequency and statistical significance. The exact significance of it in the MS process is not clearly known. It's not even, although it is clearly there and everybody can find it, it's not so different from the population that doesn't have MS that you can use it to detect people with MS. But it's clearly there, and someday when we better understand MS, we'll have a better idea why that marker is important to the disease. It's not a treatment, and as far as I know, there's nothing being used that targets any process tied to HLA DR6.
Okay. It's apparently in some sort of study for remyelination. Is that anything that you've heard about?
It may be that you have to have that marker in order to be in the study. that maybe it was shown to work only in a subpopulation that had the DR6 marker.
Okay.
I would suspect that's the case.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Well, it is 8 o'clock on the dot, so again, Dr. Ford, we really appreciate you spending this time with us tonight and for all of your knowledge and information that you've provided. I want to thank everybody again for joining us this evening and remind you that next month at the same time as the second Wednesday of the month at 7 o'clock, or is it the third Wednesday? It's the second Wednesday. Sorry, a little mixed up. We're going to be doing another teleconference. This one will be for caregivers, so it's going to be called Coping as a Caregiver. I think it should be a really interesting teleconference on giving some real tips and tools for people who are providing care to people with multiple sclerosis and hopefully helping them with their continuing care duties. So thank you so much again, Dr. Ford, and everyone for joining us. If you're interested in next month's teleconference, please call 1-800-344-4867 to register for that teleconference. And everyone have a great evening. Thank you.